bit do today is expand a little bit about on what we did last time. So Mr. Recall. We look at abelian gauge theory. In one plus one dimension. The key formulae we found was that before symplectic reduction, the phase space was given by U of theta, which is just the gauge field pointing in this spatial direction, and P of theta, which is the time derivative of the gauge field. And these have the Poisson bracket. So these are, you know, canonically conjugate variables, but that when we symplectically reduced, well, this symmetry we reduce by also depends on theta. So the Noether charge we're going to use to perform the symplectic reduction is a function of theta. So I call it mu theta, and this turned out to be d theta p theta is used to symplectically reduce. So what I'd like to do first today is maybe to spend a couple of minutes figuring out what happens in higher dimensions. Suppose we're in physical space-time dimensions, v space in one time, and I'm studying, again, abelian gauge theory, so quantum electrodynamics. What is the phase space before and after symplectic reduction? So it gets a little more complicated. So to explain it, we need to introduce some notation, because the gauge field has four components instead of two components. I'm going to use I as an index for space. So the gauge field can be written as A I dx I plus A d t. So something that's a little different in this case. So the Yang-Mills, the Lagrangian is built from the field strength. And in the one plus one dimensional case, the field strength, which is a two form, always has one leg along space and one leg along time. But here, well, there is that there is those components of the field strength which mix these guys. But there's also purely spatial components of the field strength. So I'm going to use the spatial field strength, ij, is, since it's an abelian gauge theory, it's just this E of the spatial gauge field, or in coordinates, f ij is EXI KJ minus JI. So the final thing we're going to need is that, well, since the field strength is a two form, it's an anti-symmetric tensor. And in dimension three, yeah, spatial dimension three, there are three anti-symmetric tensors, dx1, dx2, dx1, dx3, dx2, dx3. So these actually live in the same representation as the vector representation. So I can turn this two form into a one form. That one form is called star. Star F. I is epsilon AKL FKL EIJ. So I use an epsilon tensor and I lower an index. So, but all that's going on is, you know, this is just another convenient way of rewriting my field strength that has the same number of components. Okay. So what we're going to find is in 3 plus 1 dimensions, a new board. Before we do symplectic reduction, the phase spaces is given by vector UIX, which is just a gauge field. And I'm going to have a canonically conjugate vector too. But the funny thing is, the canonically conjugate vector is not just the derivative. It's something involving a mixing the derivative and the field. EI X is del T AI X plus. I'll say this is the spatial field. And then these are canonically conjugate. And we do symplectic reduction. Mu x is gij xij. So it's the same kind of thing. So I'm not sure how much we're going to learn from this. I'm kind of just doing it for completeness because I feel, you know, QED is a pretty important thing, and we should be able to figure out what its phase space is and what its Hamiltonian is too. I've got to write the Hamiltonian over here. In the 1D case, the Hamiltonian is just B squared, and here it's also just. So it's the integral over x, g I j d I of x. So it's really just. So again, it's this nice thing where before symplectic reduction, at each point in space, we have like three fields, and they just look like free particles which don't talk to each other. Symplectic reduction mixes them all together because it involves derivatives. I'm going to spend like 1 or 2 minutes just figuring out how to get here. Is there any questions?
Well, I do have a couple of questions. So just as a quick reminder, the fact that the time component of the A is not dynamical, which is a claim that's usually made when quantizing electromagnetism. A0 somehow is only enforcing a constraint, or depends. When did we arrive at the conclusion? What made us conclude that? In both cases? And, yeah.
Well, when we looked at the Lagrangian, remember the Lagrangian for just a particle where we do symplectic reduction had this kind of expression, del T phi squared. And we looked at the Lagrangian for abelian gauge theory, and it was exactly like. That's how we.
Something similar would happen here. That
exactly, except it's going to be a bit more complicated because it's not just the derivative.
Yeah.
The thing that appears here is the whole field strength, which has a bunch of other components.
Yeah.
That's the only difference.
Okay. So, okay, out of an argument like that, okay, one could conclude something similar here.
Yeah.
Okay, and with regards to, so it seems mu is the divergence.
Yeah. Exactly.
Okay, so is somehow setting mu to zero is somehow setting the Coulomb gauge, I feel, or maybe...
No, it's canonically conjugate to that.
No, yeah, because it's not the Q, it's the divergence of the P.
Exactly. So if you figure out what mu is, we can write it, mu is del LIPI, it's going to look like this, del E L I A I is the Coulomb gauge, its time derivative,
yeah,
plus something involving the derivative of this guy.
Yeah.
This is actually equal to zero by the Bianchi identity.
Okay.
So it's something a little like the Coulomb gauge.
Saying it's conserved, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
So what? And I'm also remembering something from last lesson. A tau ends appeared, or in this case, a mu of theta appears here, which is, it means there's more than, it's like more than one charge. It's an infinite amount of...
It's a charge which depends on space.
Yeah. Or in the other case, depending on the modes.
Well, it's the same thing. We just take a charge from the space and take its Fourier expansion.
Yes. So, last time I mentioned it, but another second theorem, I think, says something like there's an infinite tower of charges that are set to zero. So that's what's happening here as well. Now is that true? First of all, I don't remember if that claim is true.
I forget the various ways of writing of this.
Okay. But we are setting all the mu ends to zero.
Exactly. Yeah. So it is an infinite tower of charge, zero.
Maybe one last claim would be
mm-hmm.
that something feels slightly contradictory there in the sense that it seems like it's super highly constrained in the sense that you have infinite things that, but then you have also gauge freedom, which means your phase space is actually severely not defined or severely not constrained to the point of, well, I don't know. I just find that interesting. I don't know if there's any interesting remarks to be made about that. The fact that it's very constrained on one end, but at the same time, we have a lot of freedom.
Yeah, I feel like gauge symmetry and constraints are canonically conjugate procedures. Right, if you want to say my gauge field is physically equivalent when I add on the derivative of something, then you are forced to say that the canonically conjugate momentum is constrained.
Okay.
Because if you think about up there, look at that equation for the Poisson brackets, and you say, well, I want Q is just identical to Q plus a derivative, what gauge symmetry is. And then if you want this equation still to hold, I think you'll find the derivative of P has to be set to zero.
Okay, so that's an intuition related to that. Okay, so the momentum conjugate must be severely constrained in order for you to have such freedom in the other side.
Exactly. And maybe quickly say a more mathematical way of doing this. So my Q is a one form on space. So it's omega 1 of my spatial manifold. My P, I can alternatively view it as a one form on space as well, or by, as we did a minute ago, identifying one and two forms. Using the star operation. And then the constraint is that dp is zero. In this language. So one way to say the math description is that the phase space is the symplectic reduction of the space of two forms times the space of one forms by the group of zero forms. Zero forms act descending u to u plus. This is just an absolutely equivalent way of saying what we said in coordinates, but in more abstract differential form language. Okay, so let me very quickly explain how we get here. Because there's really no essential difference between this case and the 1 plus 1 dimensional case. So how do we do this? Well, the full field strength is equal to the spatial field strength plus dTAI. Minus del IAT. So the Amiel's Lagrangian is like the integral of the full field strength squared. Kind of schematically. So if we try to expand it in this way, where it's like something involving, I kind of separate off the term involving the time-like gauge field. It looks like the following. DTAI, that's what we had before. So this looks exactly like almost one dimensional case, plus an extra term, which comes from the spatial field strength. Then maybe minus I AT. Then I square that. So I hope it's clear that if I just call this, if I just declare that this is P, then this expression will be canonically conjugate, and it will be exactly. feel like this was, yeah, I wanted you guys to be able to see this example, but I do feel it's kind of challenging, so.
I'm not sure, so you're saying P is conjugate to R, like X, which is the del I. I'm not sure I see where the star F comes into the canonical conjugate here.
So let's, I think to understand what's going on, let's consider a particle again. So if I had something like integral del t phi, and then over here, minus a t, and suppose I just had some other term here, some expression, I'll call it expression just in terms of phi. It's easiest to see what the canonically conjugate variables are and what the mu is when you write it in the first order formulation. So, if I say q, well, little q, it's not a field, q is phi, and p is del t phi q phi, and the claim is that this Lagrangian UDP plus half p squared. Am I getting this right? No, I'm making a mistake. Sorry. I think I was too quick when I was writing this in my notes. I think I made a mistake at this step, and I think what I said is almost correct, but I'll have to, yeah, I won't be able to the bottom of it right now. So I'll erase this, let me erase this and think about it. Sorry about that. I'll clarify things in my head and like explain, I'll do it tomorrow. So the other topic I wanted to talk about today was quantization. The deformation quantization. And this is what mathematicians would call canonical quantization. So what does this mean? So if our symplectic manifold is R2 with coordinates p and q and omega is like dq dp, so you know our conventions are so the Poisson bracket of p and q is 1. In deformation, our canonical quantization, what you do is you say these variables p and q, I will now think of them as non-commuting variables, and this relation will be uplifted to the Heisenberg canonical computation relation. Why, well, it's an obvious question, you know, why do we do such a thing? Which, you know, the answer that Heisenberg told us to is not a good answer. But before we get there, we can ask, like, what does it even mean to do this? Suppose I had a general manifold. What does this even mean? My general manifold doesn't have any particular coordinate system. We'd like to formulate precisely what it means to take your ordinary commuting functions and make them non-commutative. Suppose we have a general symmetric manifold, we let C infinity of M be the collection of infinitely differentiable functions. All right, so this is, you know, the functions you might naturally think of, sine, cos, polynomials, whatever. You just don't want to allow anything with any jumps or anything with any sharp corners, that kind of thing. So that will cause problems. You say a deformation quantization is a new way of multiplying is normally written as F star G, and the output of this new way of multiplying is going to be a series in H bar. Whose first term is just the usual product. And whose second term is the Poisson bracket. And then it keeps going forever. So what's going to happen in practice is that we'll see an example. These expressions are going to be given by differentiating f a bunch of times, differentiating g a bunch of times, and contracting the indices in some way. And what do we want this to satisfy? The most important thing we want to satisfy is that it's associated. If we can build such a it's called a star product, then the functions on my manifold with this product should be thought of as operators in the quantum mechanical system. Quantizes the classical system.
R squared, is this defined recursively where you would plug it in again for star squared and like get another product in Poisson bracket? Or star two?
Yeah, I mean, yes, I mean, this is, it's on like a global manifold. This is a really complicated thing to figure out. And for many years, nobody even knew if you could do this or not. But if you work in coordinates, you know, P and Q, then this term is like an expression involving two Poisson brackets. And this term is an expression involving three Poisson brackets, and so on.
Is this somehow related to the Moyal product?
Yes, exactly. If in the local patch, the Moyal product does solve this problem.
We can exponentiate this expression.
Yes, in for the Moyal product, you can indeed write this as kind of an exponential. But for a more global kind of curves and likely manifold, there's nothing so simple. So let me, I was going to explain the formula for the Moyal product. So locally, so instead of taking coordinates P and Q, it's kind of convenient just to treat P and Q symmetrically for this calculation. I, where the symplectic form is omega ij dx I wedge dx j and omega ij is constant, so it's independent of x. Well then I can raise the indices, get an expression like this. So the Poisson bracket is related to this expression with raised indices. So locally, the formula is well, let it appear f star g. Well, the first term is just the product. The second term is the Poisson bracket, but the Poisson bracket looks like this: omega I j, df, dx I, dg, dx j, h bar, plus h bar squared, omega I j, omega k l, 2 f, dx I, dx k. 2g, dx, j, dx, l. So here, as you were saying, you use two copies of the Poisson bracket, and there's two derivatives. And it goes on in a similar fashion. And there is a slick formula for it, which maybe you will correct me if I get it wrong. So it looks like e to the h bar times omega ij df g by dxi tensor d by dxj f g, or this d by dxi, this hits f, this guy hits g. So you get this kind of slick exponential formula. And you can, you know, check that this is indeed associative. I don't think it's quite obvious, but it is. And how should we think of this? If f looks like some thing of order n. I'm going to draw it like this. And G looks like something of order m. I'll draw it like this. Well, this formula is just really given by the Wick contractions. Firstly, there's something with no Wick contractions. This is just FG plus something with one Wick contraction. Boston bracket plus something with two Wick contractions. And so on. The rule is when you see a Wick contraction, we differentiate things in each end.
So if our fields weren't polynomial, we will have an infinite sum of Wick contractions?
Yes. But it'll converge well because each term, when you have n Wick contractions, has a 1 over n factorial in it. It'll generally won't be so bad.
I don't quite get what you meant by when you Wick contract, you take derivatives.
Well, you know, this is when I differentiate a polynomial of order n, get a polynomial of order n minus 1. When I do a Wick contraction, take a polynomial of order n, order m. If I do a single Wick contraction, I get something of order n minus 1 times m minus 1. So each Wick contraction is a certain. Is differentiating each side and multiplying them together. But you know, there's a bunch of possible derivatives, and we're just contracting those indices using the symplectic form. And hopefully we can see later that these big contractions are like literally the Feynman diagrams you see in quantum mechanics, which is kind of why this is a good thing to do. Okay, so we've set up saying, like, you've given a general definition, like, what does it mean to quantize? We replace the usual multiplication by this non-commutative multiplication, and we'd like it to be in a series, starting with ordinary multiplication, and the next term is a Poisson bracket, and we want it to be a sylse. And we can see if we work in a patch, if we do this, we get something kind of familiar. And that's just a way of writing the canonical commutation relations. You know, if you work in coordinates with p and q, and just use the canonical commutation relation for p and q, and figure out what you do, how does some polynomials in p and q commute? You find you have to do a bunch of contractions. You'll get this expression. So one question though is like, why does this even make sense? So for this to make sense, if we look at our formula, we'd want to say that when we throw away the terms involving h-bar squared and higher, this better be an associative algebra. So let's check this. Working modulo h bar squared, that is like the first order. Why does fg plus h bar fg find an associative algebra? So this question is, you know, asking, why are the algebraic properties we see in classical mechanics, why are they consistent with what one sees in quantum mechanics? So to check this, we need an identity that the Poisson bracket satisfies. Poisson bracketing with any f is locally looks like this. So it involves differentiating once. So anytime we differentiate once, we have the Leibniz rule. So if I'm here, I'm differentiating gh once, so the derivative either hits g or hits h, I'll get two terms. So similarly, I can also do this for the first insertion in the Poisson brackets. Okay, so these equations are enough to tell us that this expression is an associative algebra. So let's check this. So we're going to check this just by expanding out both sides and checking they're the same. So the left-hand side is f, g, h, the ordinary multiplication, plus, well, order h bar term is h bar times f, g, h. So if I think, like, what's the order h bar term, I could either have the order h bar term coming from here, in which case I'm taking the Poisson bracket of g and h, but I could also have it coming from here, in which case I'm taking the ordinary product of g and h, Poisson bracket with f. And the right hand side, I also get fgh plus h bar Poisson bracket of fgh plus h bar Poisson bracket of f times gh. And each side is like high order terms, which you're not going to worry about. And you use the Leibniz rule, you can see that these two things are the same. I won't write it all out, but I hope it's reasonably clear for instance, this term with FGH, I get a Poisson bucket of F and G multiplied by H, Sakai. Also a Poisson bucket of F and H multiplied by G. This term will give me that Poisson bucket of F and H multiplied by G, as well as that term. They all just cancel. Okay. Any questions?
Sorry, I think I missed the motivation. Why are we specifically looking at modulo h bar square case?
Well, we want to say, you know, if you have a symplectic manifold, and we've kind of guessed that a good way to think about a quantization of that classical system is to replace your algebra functions by a non-commutative algebra. I want to check that procedure is consistent. So, if when we work modulo h bar squared, this is not associative, then this says that it doesn't make any sense to even ask for a quantization of this classical system. This is a necessary condition for a quantization to exist.
Do we also ask for this like construction to be associated with like other orders as well? Like
no, we would like it to be associated with all orders. But the easy check we can, but that's kind of a harder problem because I don't actually know. If I want to look at associativity of the next order, we have to try some guesses for what the next term of the product is and see whether we can make it associative. That's kind of a hard problem. But this one, we know what the subleading term is. We can just check, is it associative to this order?
One question is that how is this star product related to commutator of operators?
Yes.
And what if we want an anti-commutative product instead of commutative, like in Fermi?
Yeah, okay. So for the first question, the star product is, this is my time in my quantum mechanical system. Operators. Space of operators is the space of functions on M. Because you know, in quantum mechanics, what can I measure? I can measure position, momentum, polynomials in position and momentum, maybe infinite sums of those, but there's nothing else. Because the second derivative of position vanishes by momentum conservation. So all of the operators I can build are functions of my manifold. And this star product is I take an operator here, t equals 0, an operator here, some positive value of t, it's the limit when t goes to 0 from above of these two things. So if I wanted to measure it, you know, what's an operator? Maybe this, I think of some way of changing my system. I do one thing, I do the other thing a very small amount later in time.
Anomalies could arise where classically operator
classical
functions commute.
That's a really good question. So let me I could explain how a toothed anomalies arise where a system classically has some symmetry, but it gets spoiled at higher order by this. Is that the kind of thing you have in mind? So, let me see. Back. So if we have a free particle, say, n free particles, my phase basis coordinates pi, ui, and omega is this. This has an action of the group SON, and the currents are let's see. I'm not sure I'm going to get all the details right, but you can imagine where I have some mu's, which are quadratic expressions. Like pq, p squared, or q squared. And the Poisson bracket of the mu's satisfy some algebra. This will be the classical symmetry. But that the commutator of the mu's is not, because terms with two Wick contractions. For instance, if this guy was like PQ, PQ, we'll have a term where this guy is contracted with that, and that's contracted with that. Sorry, I was having trouble right at the board thinking about a nice example where this, some nice algebra is satisfied, but then when I try to quantize, it fails because of these things. It can be done. Yeah.
Can we think of this as the Poincaré algebra, but in order to quantize, we need to take a Cauchy surface instead of like the dilations don't, not like the k mu vectors corresponding to time translations don't satisfy the commutation relation.
But the thing corresponding to time translation is the Hamiltonian. I mean, there's no space in it. Like, if I just take a symplectic manifold, it's a particle moving. There's no it's like a 0 + 1 dimensional.
I'm a bit confused about that diagram over there. What do you say? Operators are basically the same thing as the infinity functions on our manifold.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a bit confused because I think of operators naturally living on some vector space.
Yes.
And I really don't see where that
we didn't,
is coming in this particular.
This is more like the Schrodinger picture. We didn't build a vector space in which they act. We've just, these are the collections of operators, p's and q's. I didn't say there was any vector space in which they act. And then instead of saying the Hamiltonian is something which acts in my Hilbert space, you can say, well, my operators evolve. The operators evolve by the time derivative of f, which is Hamiltonian. It would be, so now we might imagine building this algebra. You might say, can I build a Hilbert space in which this algebra really acts, that I can really operators, and that's another question, which is part of the story, but it's kind of hard.
Yeah, because connected to that, and quantum mechanics at least, we do have operators that are not just functions of p's and q's, right? We have operators of spin and stuff like that, where
right. But then, if I had fermions or something like that, I would also have like anti-commuting elements in my symplectic manifold classically, and then I would have something involving the anti-commutation relation, and then the stuff involving spin would be built from those.
So just to reiterate, so the because it somehow the algebra we're trying to build is h bar is interpolating between at h bar equal to zero the theory is classical somehow at h bar non-zero the we contain the information of it contains the information of the quantum mechanical information so okay so this made it somewhat clear that okay out of this algebra we want to construct time evolution using a commutator with the Hamiltonian. What is if I keep to order h bar alone, or I'm having trouble seeing how this ultimately, let's say, with a finite h bar connects to the let's say a Hilbert space with a. I can see clearly how it goes to the classical when h bar goes to zero.
Right.
I find it hard to see what's the information we're trying to capture when h bar is non-zero. We have something that's non-commutative for sure.
Yes.
And we've only imposed associativity.
Yes.
What other how do I relate this with the quantum mechanicness of, I don't know, Hilbert spaces and operators? If I have X and P, well, I don't know. I'm struggling.
I feel like everybody has learned quantum mechanics by focusing on X and P acting on functions of X by raising and lowering operators.
Yeah.
But there's an awful lot you can do without mentioning the Hilbert space.
Just with the algebra alone, I suppose. But
yes. So suppose I put the system on a circle. I make time periodic, or choose some boundary conditions. Let's make time periodic for simplicity. And the algebra is enough to tell you all. The algebra and the Hamiltonian is enough to tell you all correlation functions.
Okay. And why do we need all the other orders in H bar? Why is it not simply something that is? It has this H bar correction, and that now it's non-commutative, and now it contains an algebra that satisfies.
Well, think about what's the commutator between p squared and q squared?
The commutator between p squared and q squared?
It has like something. Where was I? This was a not very well known example, but. So like p is d by d, h bar d by dq. Has a bunch of terms. So one term will be like, I don't know, 2q2 h bar squared q d by q. That's like 2 h bar qp. But there'll also be a term which is something like h bar squared times 1. So the commutator between p and q looks like h bar, a decent factor of 2 or 4 or something. So if I take a complicated expression in p and q, associativity forces their commutator to have all order stuff. Now, suppose I hadn't chosen coordinates. I just had two functions. What's the formula? Like, what's the formula for the commutator of some function here and some function here? Because they can have arbitrary dependence on p and q, it can go as far as you like. And if you just unravel it, you'll find this formula for the Moyal product, all these derivatives.
Having a Poisson structure is sufficient to define star product, or do we need symplectic structures?
Ah, that's a great question. There's a very famous theorem of Konstevich from about 20 years ago that proves that for any Poisson structure, you can find a star product. This is extremely hard because your Poisson structure, you don't have a local canonical form. It doesn't locally look like dp dq.
It's
going to locally look like dx dy times some crazy function of x. So locally, the Moyal product formula just doesn't make any sense. So he wrote down, he used the path integral to prove you could do it. And if in the symplectic case, it's easier because locally everything is the same. But then there's a tricky question of gluing everything together between different coordinate patches. And this was solved by a mathematician named Fedosov. No, one more remark, and I don't know. We'll try to translate a bit into the Lagrangian language. So this identity is the Jacobi identity. This holds for any Poisson bracket. And it's necessary for the existence of a star product. So suppose you were to go away and check, can I find a star product that works to the next order? At some point, you'll do a bunch of algebraic manipulations, and you'll find that this identity has to hold. So I feel it's really satisfying. Like, all of these identities that you find in the Poisson tensor, they all come just by requiring the star product is associative. So there's a very nice relationship between the quantum structure and the classical structure. I often feel that, you know, Hamilton could have discovered Heisenberg's commutation relations.
I have two questions. First, is there a physical interpretation of why we want associative algebras?
Yeah. Let me explain that. Because I have three operators. So what's F star G star H? This would be first send T1 to 0, and then T2 to 0. Whereas F star G star H, you first send T2 goes to T1, and then T1 goes to 0. These have to be the same, because in any computation, inserting these three operators is some reasonable function of their positions. So I'll get the same answer. If I take the limits in a different order, you should get the same answer. And that's just, that's.
And this is independent of the space time, of the space.
That's a subtle question. So in if just for quantum mechanics, this all works beautifully. Suppose we try to think in Lorentzian signature, and it'll work nicely, but it depends on some kind of subtle properties of the Cauchy in Lorentzian signature. You can build any solution on spacetime once I've specialized the initial data. So the Cauchy problem is well posed in Lorentzian signature. That's not true in Newtonian. If you in Newtonian signature, you specify the initial data, you can get singularities very quickly. It's some issue with PDEs, so this actually doesn't work quite as well. So it's a bit technical. Oh. Now, when you guys studied quantum field theory, did you ever derive the canonical commutation relations? Oh, yes.
How did we get a metric? I thought we only had a symplectic manifold.
No, you're right, we had a symplectic manifold. So this issue of the difference between Euclidean and Lorentzian comes about because if my symplectic manifold is infinite dimensional, that can cause annoying subtle problems with this argument.
Yes, but also like earlier when we were doing the 3+1 dimensional
yes.
Example,
yes.
The star F was defined with a metric.
Was defined with
beta and then.
Yes.
So I don't really understand how that works with our, because my assumption is our functions are living on a symplectic manifold of some two form.
Well, the way the symplectic manifold comes about is you start with the Lagrangian, and then you look at the space of solutions to the equations of motion, and that'll be your symplectic manifold. Now, it could happen that the Lagrangian I started with depended on a metric. So the metric on, so if I start with a particle, with a free scalar field theory, I needed to give you a metric on space-time to talk about that. The phase space, like the symplectic manifold, is very different from the space-time manifold. So we don't get a metric on the phase space necessarily. So when you guys studied quantum field theory, so did you derive the canonical commutation relations or no? No? Okay, you really should have, because I find this kind of just declaring that they must be true is kind of unsatisfying. So where does this come from? Let's do an example. Do our favorite example, just a free particle, and you is phi at 0, and p is the derivative of phi 0. So we have this cartoon that the star product is given by, you do one operator and then wait a bit in time, do the other, and then take the limit. So we'd like to make this cartoon into something a bit more concrete by doing a computation of how this works. So we can say, what is phi 0, the two-point function, del t phi at t. So by studying this, we're going to derive the canonical commutation. So how would we do this? I'm going to connect them by a propagator. So does anybody remember the propagator in this case? We do Feynman diagrams? Well, a propagator is some function of t so that second derivative d of t is a delta function, t equals 0. personally, the way I like to think about, this is of course what you get by doing the Feynman rules. The Green's function is defined of the equations of motion in the presence of a source. But how do we get this? Well, the source is just the insertion of my operator at phi of 0. Solve equations of motion in the presence of the operator phi of 0. To get things off there. So the inserting the operator phi at 0 was just like integrating against a delta function. And if I vary phi, well, I might get a sign wrong. It doesn't matter. We get this equation. It is convincing that this is what the propagator is and how one derives it. Yeah.
When we say inserting the operator, can we? How do we think this from the path integral? Because if
yeah, so the path integral is going to be like integral over all field configurations, exponential of the integral of the real line. Maybe there's a factor of I or something. And then that. The two-point function I'm computing is this. So we're just using the Feynman rules for this path integral. And because it's a free theory, I'm inserting two operators. The result is going to be a single wick contraction. That's what we have to compute. And you know, as always, to compute the wick contraction, we have to compute the propagator. The propagator satisfies this equation. So what is it? The answer is the propagator is absolute value of t. I think I'm dropping a bunch of signs, but let's not worry about that. So that means it goes like for t positive, the propagator is t, and for t negative, propagator is minus t. So it looks like this kind of V shape. So why is this the propagator? Well, I want its second derivative to be a delta function. So the first derivative of the propagator looks like this. 0 here, I think there's a half. Sorry, signs and factors of 2 are propagable. So the first derivative of the propagator, it looks like So it's plus a half for t positive, minus a half t negative. So then there's a jump of one to go from negative to positive. So the second derivative is a delta. Okay, so let's go and think about what the two-point function. So I have to put my one operator 0 and one operator at t and connect them by the propagator. If I didn't have this derivative, you would say, oh, the two-point function of phi with itself, that just is the propagator, the definition of it. Now with this derivative, it means I have to differentiate it. So we see the two-point function jumps. It's a half up here, and when they cross each other, minus a half. So, can you guys see that this is the canonical commutation relation? Position and momentum when they're positive is half, and when they're negative, it's minus a half. So, position times momentum is limit equals to 0 from above, expectation value of this, whereas if I do it in the other way, E star Q, that's the limit. Because the product is in the other way, momentum is coming from below. B equals to 0 below. Minus a. So the difference between them is the commutator. One, or if we include the factors of h-bar, it would be h-bar. And I think I've made a sign error. So.
What happens if the momentum is some more complicated function of q, so that we repeat this computation and we don't get a constant?
Absolutely, yeah. So I've written it only discussing the expectation value, but this computation is actually valid for the operator, the composite operator we get by looking at the difference between the limits in positive and negative. So if I had something more complicated here, phi of 0 and like, I don't know, phi squared del phi t, I would still, well, to do some more complicated computation in general, if this is a free theory, I would just do a bunch of Wick contractions. You'd have to sum over all possible Wick contractions. Of course, you get something more complicated, and this would lead you, if you're careful, to the formula for the Moyal product. But in particular, if the other operator we're inserting was more complicated, you would find, for example, commutator of Q with P squared looks like, you know, H bar times 2P. Is this the kind of thing you're thinking about?
No, I think that my question was more like, if in our theory, P is not the derivative of the field, but the kinetic term of our field is a fourth order.
Using, like, I suppose the kinetic term was fourth order. That's a very interesting question. Well, if the kinetic term was fourth order, you'd see what's the propagator? It's going to be, propagator will be the cubic thing here, because you have to differentiate it. You want it to be so that when you differentiate it twice, you get a Heaviside step function. And then you see that the thing, because we're taking this limits of f position and the third derivative of momentum, or sorry, the position and the third derivative of position would satisfy the same canonical computation. But if I took a lower derivative, like the second, when I took the limit, that would disappear, so those would commute. So in that case, position and third derivative would be canonically conjugate, but first and second derivative would also be canonically conjugate.
Why were we able to pick our propagator to be 1/2 absolute value of t?
Well, the propagator is defined to be the thing that satisfies this equation, that its second derivative is a delta.
But to me, that should be something like 1 over t, right? Like if we want something like if you want it to blow up at t, right?
I mean, if you were to study a propagator in dimension 3 or 4, yes, it would blow up at t. It just so happens that in dimensions 1 and 2, especially dimension 1, propagator has no singularities. It's continuous, not differentiable. I think the way you can convince yourself of this is by dimensional analysis. If you look at phi dt squared phi, what dimension does phi have to be for that to make sense? It's something like minus 1/2. And that tells you the behavior of the propagator. Does that help? I mean, for me, it's really to solve the differential equation. You could solve it using a Fourier transform if you wanted. It is the Fourier. By Fourier transform this, and P is the canonical conjugate variable, it is the Fourier transform of 1 over p squared.
I'm just trying to understand the expression that the expectation value of between two operators. So it's defined through a path integral.
Mm-hmm.
I guess, is the path integral well defined in our construction?
Path integrals for free theories are generally very well defined, because all you need to do is do a bunch of Wick contractions between whatever operators you've inserted. Now here we're in an even better situation for quantum mechanical theories, because the propagator has, you know, the difficulties in the path integral come from the fact that the propagator has these nasty singularities. You want to integrate a function which is very singular. But here the propagator has no singularities whatsoever. So actually the path integral of quantum mechanics is fine.
If we use the same argument for fermions, then we should have a plus there instead.
Yes, exactly. Because you would, yeah, there'd be like a sign change when you go from here to here, and it would be a plus. So if you were to do the whole thing with fermions, you would have to talk about symplectic supermanifolds, where your symplectic manifold is anti-commuting coordinates as well as commuting coordinates. Then there's a superposition bracket, which is symmetric instead of anti-symmetric. And then, but everything else goes.
Coming back to the question from before, if something that commutes at the classical level, for example, these mu's, and then, however, when I quantize them, they become second-class constraints. But then if I look at this expectation value, it seems as if this is still zero, because in a path interval, only the classical commutator arises. So does it then have no influence on the fact that they are not commuting?
So you're thinking about the, setting the mu's to be zero, like doing some symplectic reduction? I'm not sure it quite follows.
I was more specifically thinking of constraints in gravity, for example.
Yes.
Class when you contrast them.
Uh-huh.
Because the expectation value is an expectation value of operators.
Yes.
So what is in there is something that is non-zero because of the second class. But then this expectation value computed via the path integral is something that involves the classical commutator, which is zero. So this object seems to evaluate to zero.
No, but the expectation value knows about the quantum commutator because when you have my two operators, I do my path integral, I do some weak contractions between them. Those weak contractions give you the quantum commutator. So in general, if I have two operators, their expectation value will have singularities when the two operators coincide. Those singularities are determined by the quantum commutator. Are discontinuities. Make sense?
Like, why is the Moyal product limit of t tending to zero? G of t.
Like, why is that formula true, or?
Like, the way we define Moyal product, we never assume that f and g have to be at different times, and then we have to take the limit of.
Well, normally you would just define it by a formula on the symplectic manifold, right? So the usual definition doesn't refer to time at all. I think the key point to understand is, like, quantum mechanics, you have a non-commutative algebra. What is the meaning of the product? The meaning is you do something and then you do something else.
The Moyal product?
The Moyal product is the same one in a different basis that Heisenberg and so on considered in the 20s. So any of the non-commutative products of observables.
So on this particular matter, we can define an associative algebra of operators.
Yes.
We have expectation values, so we can do quantum mechanical computations.
Yes.
Under what circumstances is this construction, does this construction give rise to the usual Hilbert space problem?
That's a good question. So to build a Hilbert space, you want to build a representation of the algebra. I suppose in this particular case, I don't know if this is going to help you. You could be very formal and say, oh, there's this old theorem of Stoneman and Neumann that tells you this algebra only has one representation. I will take that, and that's my Hilbert. If I had a more complicated symplectic manifold, it's a more subtle thing, but there's something called geometric quantization that's supposed to produce a Hilbert space.
Yeah. Well, with regards to your question, what's the name of Moyal algebra? Moyal?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah, if you map Q and P to their operators and they usually work with, the Moyal product is simply the composition between the operators.
Absolutely, yeah.
Just so far. And so yeah, you would just have to map in that way.
Yeah.
Maybe, and with regards to the limit, why is that? So it's something like that should be related then in some sense to if you make the composition of if you think of the operators in the Heisenberg picture, somehow they're singular for the same time for their composition at the same time and that's where they're taking the limit or some sense. Like
yes.
Because it seems like the definition could buy itself together the limit, but I suppose we could simply say it's the product at the same time. But
in a particular theory, exactly, there's a discontinuity. It matters.
Yeah, the ordering, the time ordering thing.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose that's related to why we take the limit. Okay.
No, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you could say that if you wanted to do it at the limit, you could say all we're computing is one operator, e to the t of the Hamiltonian, and the other operator. That's what we would get if there was a finite distance between them. But it's better to take a nicer just take t to zero. Okay, I will see you all tomorrow.